I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. It was a noisy, angry, and chaotic Democratic presidential debate last night in Charleston, South Carolina, hosted by CBS. The seven candidates largely ignored the time constraints and the moderators. As predicted, Senator Sanders, the front runner, was in the crosshairs after his big win in Nevada last Saturday. This Saturday's primary in South Carolina is a test about how these candidates, all of them white, four are septuagenarians, two are billionaires, will connect with black voters who were the majority of Democrats in the state. Vice President Biden, who has struggled in the three previous contests, has staked his candidacy on South Carolina and just got the endorsement of Congressman Clyburn of South Carolina. Senator Warren said she'd be a better progressive president than Sanders and took on Mayor Bloomberg, as she did in the last debate. Mayor Buttigieg and Senator Klobuchar argued that political moderation was the winning message. Tom Steyer, who has spent a lot of money in South Carolina, argued for reparations and had to defend Biden's attack about investing in private prisons. Well, today on Radio Times, we're going to play clips from last night's debate and talk about what it all means. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Imani Perry is professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Imani, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks.
Also with us, Michael Jones Correa. He's professor of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Immigration at the University of Pennsylvania. Michael, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And rounding out our trio of guests, Kelly Dittmar. She's assistant professor of political science at Rutgers at their Camden campus, also scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics, also at Rutgers. And Kelly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. What the heck happened last night? Imani, let me begin with you. I mean, it was angry. It was chaotic. It was kind of a big mess. And I have to say, I overheard a number of people, even people on my commute coming to work, saying, I think I hate them all.
Right. I mean, it was incredibly chaotic. It was a poorly managed debate. There was also an air of desperation amongst the candidates, in particular around the question of race, where they seemed to be largely pointing the fingers at, you know, you did something bad to black people and you did something bad to black people. And then without really a substantive conversation on the issues that matter to South Carolina Democratic voters, who are predominantly black. And so it didn't feel as though it was useful for clarifying the positions of the candidates or for helping people who were undecided at all, in fact.
Well, Kelly, this is the 10th one of these debates. Do you think they've run their course? I mean, have we learned where they stand on all these issues or
not?
Surprisingly,
I think there are a lot of issues that we still haven't spent a lot of time in debates talking about. And I think Imani's point about the depth with which we talk about issues is always a problem in debates. And as we have fewer people on the debate stage, that should actually give more opportunity for them to speak in depth. But what we did see last night is the moderators cutting off any attempt to get into any single issue in a real way. And of course, issues like climate change a number of issues we could go down the list that didn't come up last night or even very much in previous debates. So I think there's opportunity for these to be effective. Last night was just not a great example of one in which people were learning a lot from watching.
And Michael, what was your perspective? And on the one hand, it seemed that the moderators were AWOL for a while, and then they came in and tried to impose some law and order on what was happening on the stage.
Yes, it improved after that first break. Before then, it was really a kind of a free-for-all where moderators had lost control, and it wasn't clear that they really had a plan going in about how to moderate that debate. Even their questioning sort of jumped around from topic to topic rather than delving in, and it could have been a more illuminating debate if there had been some real chance for the candidates to go deeper into any particular topic.
Let me just, this is the news of this morning. Imani, I'll put this back to you. Congressman Clyburn, he is the majority whip in the House, a very important player among Democrats and certainly in South Carolina. He endorsed Joe Biden. How significant is that?
I think it's significant, although one of the things that I think candidates and even the pundit class is missing is that traditional custodial politics, according to race, where there are prominent, the kind of tradition of prominent African Americans endorsing a candidate or vouching for a candidate as a way to bring black voters to the polls, has shifted. There are lots of other spheres of influence now, social media, activists, and the like. And so I don't think that those among the candidates who are banking on that model are being sophisticated. I think that's true of Biden and also of Bloomberg, yeah. and sort of understanding the greater complexity of the of engaging with the black electorate, particularly along lines of generational difference and regional difference.
I wonder, and this is going back to Nevada, Michael, but just looking at the Latinx voters in Nevada and what an important role they played. One of the things I heard, you can correct me if I'm right or wrong, or if I'm wrong, which is that the young members of the family who vote are very influential within the family in terms of telling their parents or perhaps grandparents who they think should be president of the United States.
Yeah, this goes, I think, echoes what Imani was saying, that there's a new dynamic in the Democratic Party and more generally, I think, in where social media activism shapes people's opinions, and that flow is going from as much from younger people to the older generation as vice versa. It's a new dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm curious, Kelly, just looking ahead, and there were two women candidates, obviously Senators Warren and Klobuchar, very different, I would say, both in style and also in substance. And Warren really, as she has been in previous debates, she was raring to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think she learned, especially previous to the last debate, there was a debate before that where in New Hampshire where she didn't really get a lot in, right? And she was being relatively polite and raising her hand and waiting her turn. And I think both her and her team realized that that wasn't the strategy that was going to work. And so you saw her debate skills really shine in the last debate where she made sure that she got her points across. And last night, amidst all the chaos, there were some moments where she probably had the greatest clarity in her points because she just pushed through for a minute or a minute and a half, whatever it was, to try to actually make a clear, coherent statement, whether it be about a policy or at one point, you know, she talked about her larger message about choosing hope over fear. That was one of the few moments in the debate where I felt like somebody actually got their campaign message clearly through the moderator's interruptions and the interruptions of their peers.
Do you think we're ready for an aggressive woman candidate?
I think it's really important. It's something that certainly there are double standards to how we evaluate men and women candidates. And it's something that I've been sort of putting out there in social media. Just remember, you know, you may react differently to this type of behavior in this woman candidate than you would a male candidate. But she has been very active in calling out that bias. If right before the debate, she put out a campaign video that the motto and the headline was, "I am angry and I own it." And talked about how her anger was rooted in the situation of individuals, whether it be class-based inequalities, race-based inequalities, gender-based inequalities, and that fueled an anger to make policy change. With women, often we see the need for them to justify their anger, and that's certainly what she's doing. Mm-hmm. And it's a way for her to, yes, call out the bias, but also accommodate some of the biases by saying, no, my anger is righteous, it's justified.
Do you want to speak to that? And Imani, I'm even going back to when candidate Obama was running, and I mean, maybe just by nature, he was a careful, cautious candidate, did not show us any anger that I'm assuming as a human being he has. But he had to be very careful, it seems.
He chose to be very careful in order to be a more viable candidate. I do think that calculus says something about the values and given that the candidates have. And I do think that in the past 8 years, we have this sort of interesting, I don't know, bifurcation where there's both this kind of disturbing, lawless rightward turn, and also that there's a more robust conversation in the Democratic Party in the range from kind of centrist to leftist about what the country should be. A lot more kind of a much greater degree of openness, imagination. And so I do think that that is a piece of Warren's expression of anger is actually that the conversation is much more capacious than it was.
Well, and I think a lot of people, if I can speak for them in this country, are angry
and frustrated.
I mean, and because it feels as if the system is kind of rigged against them. You want to speak to that, Michael?
So I think Bloomberg's entrance into the debates, Nevada, now in South Carolina, has given Warren a target where she can express and channel that anger in a way in which Democratic primary voters will be more or less sympathetic. Mm-hmm. I think there's a sense that I think among Democratic primary voters that you probably shouldn't be able to sort of walk into the campaign and just sort of buy your way in. And so it's a target that Democratic voters are sympathetic with and it gives Warren a chance to position herself as a perfect foil for her and her
right.
campaign.
Right.
And, I mean, Bernie Sanders seems to be able to channel this anger. I mean, he's done this for years now. Kelly, you want to speak to that?
Well, he certainly hasn't been penalized for yelling on stage repeatedly. I mean, it's interesting. He has always expressed himself in a way that would be sort of deemed angry, but people actually don't call it that often. So, you know, the fact that you're even pointing that out is important because many people just are like, that's just him. He's just a curmudgeon. Whereas with women candidates, when there is that aggression, we notice it, right? It is contrary to expectations or the norms and rules of how we're supposed to behave. Nice women, polite women, right? And so for him, he is certainly benefited him in that people somehow find it endearing, but in a very different way. It's a very different labyrinth, if you will, that women are navigating when they're expressing that same kind of anger.
Imani, why do you think Sanders is doing so well?
I think it's a combination of his ability to really stay on message and stay on message with respect to issues that are important to people, like debt and healthcare, right? I mean, that you know, that those and you know, notwithstanding the kind of anxiety attack that the centrists of the party are having around the term Democratic Socialist, he really is in many ways an extension of the New Deal Democrat. And that continues conceptually to have some resonance with members of the base, but also with people who have been alienated by the party. So I think, you know, that he's speaking to the concerns of a large portion of the electorate.
Michael, how do you see his candidacy and the fact that he's number one?
I think he will continue to do well going into Super Tuesday. I don't think he will do particularly well in South Carolina. But I think that's in part because Latino voters in particular, I think Bernie is better positioned to appeal to Latino voters than he is to African-American voters. And I think there are two reasons for that. One of them is Biden has positioned himself as Obama's heir. And part of positioning yourself as Obama's heir is taking the responsibility for a policy around immigration in particular and around deportations that Latinos are skeptical of.
Mm-hmm.
And Sanders is able to capture and parlay that skepticism into support.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Jones-Correa. Also with us, Imani Perry and Kelly Dittmar. We're talking about last night's quote-unquote debate. And we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. To join our conversation, we've got a bunch of clips which we will play after this very short break. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
This supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with our guests about last night's debate, the state of the presidential race. Imani Perry from Princeton University, Michael Jones-Correa from the University of Pennsylvania, and Kelly Dittmar from Rutgers University at their Camden campus. Let me play a clip from last night. This is actually an edited clip of Bernie Sanders defending his comments on the Castro government's literacy program. He goes on to mention American interventions overseas.
Of course you have a dictatorship in Cuba. What I said is what Barack Obama said in terms of Cuba, that Cuba made progress on education. Yes, I think, really? Really? Occasionally, it might be good idea to be honest about American foreign policy. And that includes the fact that America has overthrown governments all over the world, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Iran. And when dictatorships, whether it is the Chinese or the Cubans, do something good, you acknowledge that.
Let me get you all to respond. But, Michael, let me start with you.
So this is one of the more interesting moments of the debate, I think, where Biden had made comments prior to the debate and was being challenged by other participants. And he did not back away.
You mean Sanders?
Sanders, I'm sorry. Sanders.
That's okay.
He did not back away. And I think that there's reason to believe that, particularly we were talking earlier about Latinx voters, there are portions of the Democratic electorate who certainly those comments seem right to them.
Yeah.
If you're Latinx in the United States, you certainly see that history of intervention in Latin America as part of the conversation, not something that's surprising. And very well may be that there's a larger portion of the electorate as well that won't find that particularly troublesome.
Yeah. But how did you see that, Kelly? And then I'll go to you, Imani.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think there's also a generational question about sort of understanding of the Cuba crisis and intervention.
Yeah.
I think when you look at Bernie's support, particularly among young people, not that I don't want to say they don't know and they don't understand, but there is a different relationship perhaps with understanding sort of or invoking Cuba and Cuba politics among this generation. So I don't know that for a fact. I am interested in wondering if that is part of what might be happening there too, in order for him to feel pretty secure about sort of doubling down on that.
And Imani, as he was talking, I was thinking of Saudi Arabia. I mean, there are countries who are our allies who have a horrendous record on human rights abuses.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is that there's this thread that is a kind of recap of Cold War politics, but without much substance in the conversation, such that those voters who do not know in any detail the history. So Nicaragua came up, for example, and it was my guess is that very few people remember the Iran-Contra scandal, right, and the illegality that was a part of that, right? And the notion that one might take a position that was actually in opposition to the kind of tradition of American interventionism that kept people from being able to control their own countries, right, the outcomes. And so I do think that it is a meaningful sort of aspect of Sanders' politics, but I am afraid that relatively few Americans have any idea really of what's going on in that conversation.
Well, I was also thinking, I mean, we overthrew the government in Iran in the 1950s,
yes.
But Iran seems to know that, but not too many Americans. Let me play another clip, and this is former Vice President Joe Biden, and he's discussing his history in South Carolina. Let's give it a listen.
My entire career has been wrapped up in dealing with civil rights and civil liberties. I don't expect anything. I plan to earn the vote. I'm here to ask. I'm here to earn. But folks, I intend to win South Carolina, and I will win the African-American vote here in South Carolina.
I mean, Iman, if I can go back to you, he's put his candidacy on the line here. I mean, he's really got to win, right?
He does have to win in order to maintain a viable campaign. I find that formulation really disturbing, the sort of, the notion that he has earned this relationship to black men. Because I think he avoids being accountable for the problems in his past, whether we're talking about, busing, as Kamala Harris talked about previously, or the crime bill, or Anita Hill. It's a kind of, but he's relying upon he mentions Obama every 50 seconds, and then also relying upon, the old model of custodianship. I actually think it'll be interesting to see who comes in second with African-American voters in South Carolina. I think that's going to indicate something, because I'm not convinced that he has it locked up the way that he thinks. He probably will come in first, but I don't think that there's going to be overwhelming support. There's been a lot of really meaningful criticism that's come out of kind of black political discourse recently. So
What do you think, Kelly?
Well, I was struck even just when he says the African-American vote.
Right.
That alone, mm-hmm. as singular, I mean, it's something that any of us who work in areas of looking at women voters or black voters know that being careful not to talk about groups as a monolith is really important. And so if you're sensitive to that, using that terminology alone is problematic. Mm. And you saw him try to throw out there this sort of rhetoric later in the debate. At the end, he, you know, makes a direct appeal, I think, in his view to black women by saying, I will nominate a black woman to the Supreme Court. That's notable. But throughout the debate, we haven't talked about all the very serious issues affecting black women in their everyday lives. In fact, I think it was only Buttigieg who talked about very briefly got cut off on black maternal health. So that is the more substantive conversation I think Imani is pointing to, like, that needs to be had, especially if we're talking about young black voters who are concerned about the substance of the policy, not just that you were the vice president for Barack Obama.
Well, and I think, Michael, there is this danger of talking about groups as monoliths or speaking with one voice, especially so-called minority groups in this country.
Right.
True for...
There's, I think the Democratic Party is often caricatured as being composed of these groups driven by identity politics. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at this primary season, that's just not true. Latino voters, Latinx voters, African-American voters, women have all been more complex in their backing of candidates than this identity politics caricature would suggest.
So time to move on, you're saying.
Right? Yes. Well, it goes back to this comment that Kelly was making that, you know, people are complicated. We can't assume that African-American voters are all going to act the same way.
Mm-hmm. Which puts pressure on the candidates to be nuanced and
have complicated answers. I mean, you can't have one message for this is how I'm going to appeal to black voters and this is how I'm going to appeal to women. And so often that is what has been done, which is here's my black platform, here's my women's platform. When we know if you have any sense of even the concept of intersectionality, broadly speaking, that you need to at least understand that people come to this with multiple and intersecting identities and therefore experiences and priorities about what they want from a candidate.
That's Kelly Dittmar from Rutgers University. Michael Jones Correa joining us. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, and Imani Perry teaches at Princeton University. And we're talking about last night's debate, the race for the White House. Some of the candidates were playing clips as well. Let me just read a comment and then take a call. A comment from Jody. Bernie's policy proposals are just extensions of social services we already have. I don't think people understand that because they're afraid of, quote unquote, socialism. I mean, he is more defined, I think, what it means for him to be a democratic socialist. Imani?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it really is challenging to kind of disaggregate what's going on because on the one hand, you know, we've had recent survey data research that shows that people don't have the same kind of negative gut reaction to the term socialist as in previous generations. But we also have a body of pundits who are kind of saying the sky is falling with the term. And it's hard to know actually how it will land with voters as a consequence. I do think that it'll be interesting, fascinating to see what happens as we move closer to the convention. I think how voters behave as a consequence.
Well, I do think he's challenged that sort of conventional thinking about what it means to be a Democrat or even to run for president.
Yes. And he's definitely, I mean, I think one thing that you can give Sanders credit for, and I think that like all of the candidates, there's a great deal to be critical about. And I think that's actually, I worry that in the kind of culture of fandom around political candidates, we shift away from demand or accountability towards like sort of this is my team, right? Like we treat them like members of sports teams. But I do think he has pushed the party to the left in general in ways that are meaningful. And that's the case irrespective of whether he's the person who is chosen as the nominee.
Well, time will tell. Let me get Bertha from, looks like Chester to join us from Radio Times. And Bertha, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
Good morning. My question is, I know and I've been trying to follow all kinds of things, but I'm hearing a lot of folks saying that they appreciate Bernie Sanders because he's been consistent with his ideas and platforms and so on for years. My question is, since he's so consistent with that, is he and can he be flexible enough to incorporate other people's ideas into what he already owns?
It's a great question, Bertha, and all three of my guests are nodding their head. But Michael, I'm going to toss it over to you just for your thoughts. Thanks for calling in Radio Times, Bertha.
Yeah, I do think this is something that we hear about Sanders, that he is authentic, and part of that authenticity is his consistency, that he doesn't sort of shift his stances with the way the wind blows. But he is actually a very canny and experienced politician, and he, if you watch how he answers the questions and the way that other candidates push back on him, he is quite good. And so it's not that he isn't capable of responding to other points of view. He is very capable, but he is consistent.
Yeah.
So finding that balance, I think, is a very tricky one for a politician, and Sanders seems to have found it.
Kelly, looks like you want to say something, then I want to play another clip.
I just wanted to say, there was a moment in the debate that actually addresses this, right? So you can be consistent, but Warren's argument against him was, but you didn't actually get anything passed. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that's important when we have conversations around electability in this moment. Are we considering the possible challenges of being electable if you don't have a record to show that you've achieved? You've been in the Senate for a very long time. You've had these beliefs. People may agree with you, and they may be consistent, but can you actually get it done? And so I think this concern about inflexibility is there, but also just the concern that you've had this agenda and we haven't actually seen it go into place. And that's why I think you see Warren saying, you and I had the same ideas, I then got it done, and then your people came and attacked me for it.
Hmm. Well, let me play another clip, and this is Elizabeth Warren, although this time aiming her allegations and criticisms against Mayor Mike Bloomberg, in which he told a pregnant employee to, quote, kill it. Let me play this. It's uncomfortable, but it's worth listening to and talking about.
When I was 21 years old, I got my first job as a special education teacher. I loved that job. And by the end of the first year, I was visibly pregnant. The principal wished me luck and gave my job to someone else. Pregnancy discrimination, you bet. But I was 21 years old. I didn't have a union to protect me, and I didn't have any federal law on my side. So I packed up my stuff and I went home. At least I didn't have a boss who said to me, kill it, the way that Mayor Bloomberg
never
alleged
said that.
To have said to one of his pregnant employees. People want a chance to hear. People want a chance to hear. From the women who
I never
worked.
Said that.
I want
and,
to allow
and
the
for the record, if she was a teacher in New York City.
And it goes on from there. Imani, what did you make of that interchange? And even listening to it now, it's
uncomfortable. I think it is extremely important, though, to raise questions about years, decades, really, of allegations about incredibly sexist behavior on the part of Bloomberg. And it's difficult to get those on the table if it's not in the context of a debate. And particularly in this moment, right? We're in the Me Too era, and we have someone who has a very similar history of allegations in the White House. And so I do find it useful, even though that was a very uncomfortable moment.
Yeah. How about for you, Kelly?
Yeah. I mean, I think obviously we saw also the success of that moment or a similar moment in the last debate for Elizabeth Warren. It was her highest, fundraising debate in the last when she attacked Bloomberg directly on the NDAs in the previous debate. Obviously, the audience reaction was a little bit different this time around. But I think Warren is genuinely, I think Michael pointed to this, she's generally offended by Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. And she's offended not only that he's trying to buy the election, but she's offended that he has a past that has been derogatory not only towards women but towards the African-American community, mm-hmm. and others, and so she is calling it out, I do think, largely on ideological positioning, and I would add that she's then was questioned after about that particular allegation. The Washington Post reported it with a witness. It was something that, so this person had both gone to court. And then there was a witness who came out later and said, yes, I heard him say those words. I was equally appalled. And I think her response is important when reporters were saying, but, you know, we don't know if that was true. We don't know if that was true. And she says, well, why shouldn't we believe the women? Why should we be believing Mike Bloomberg? And it speaks to Imani's point. We are in a moment where I think that reaction is appreciated by many women who've been in that situation.
And just a day or two after the Weinberg
Harvey Weinstein verdict.
Let me just shift gears, if I can, Michael, toss this to you. And something I learned this morning that as part of the audience last night, people paid a lot of money to attend the debate. Frankly, I didn't know that until one of my producers told me. Does that seem okay? And I'm thinking about the boos and the cheering and the back and forth. These are people who paid something like $1,700 a seat to be there.
Yes, that strikes me as unusual. We were talking a bit about this earlier before the show, how the audience reaction was unique, that often in these debates you'll have a partisan crowd that supports its candidate. And what was unusual to me listening to the debate was the negative reaction. So clearly there were portions of the audience who were not just supporting their candidate, but actively booing other candidates. And I find that odd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But paying all that money to be part of the audience, Imani, I don't know. That just seems to stick in my craw.
Yes, because it seems, you know, profoundly undemocratic, right, in terms of, you know, the ideas that the audience is going to be the constituents of that state, right? And so you get a sense, one, that they can see the candidates up close to participate in the process, but you also, you're supposed to get some kind of sense of the constituency by virtue of how they respond. And it's clear that that group is not representative of South Carolina in particular, if the seats are $1,700,
kind of
right? Yeah.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Imani Perry. She's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Also with us, Michael Jones Correa. He's a professor of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Race, Ethnicity, and Immigration at the University of Pennsylvania. And Kelly Dittmar with us as well. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at the Camden campus, across the river from us here, and scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers Eagleton Institute of Politics. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We've got more clips after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me play another clip from last night's debate. This is Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and he's discussing how much money he gave to prominent Democrats in 2018. I should add that something like 40 Democrats were elected to Congress, changed the political makeup of Congress, and Bloomberg supported many of them.
All of the new Democrats that came in, put Nancy Pelosi in charge and gave the Congress the ability to control this president, I got them.
There was a little clip there, a little slip there, Kelly. He says, I got them, meaning bought.
Yeah, absolutely.
With his money.
Yeah, I mean, in essence, it sort of just makes or fuels the continued belief that he's trying to buy this election, that he looks at elections in that way, in being able to shape the outcome by funneling money, his money, into the candidates he thinks are best, whether they are Republicans or Democrats, because we know he supported Republicans in many previous elections. The other interesting thing about it is it was reminiscent of Bloomberg also taking credit. Let me take credit for the Democrats taking over the House. Also, let me take credit for Moms Demand Action. I mean, the number of women, and that's the gun organization that was really started by moms who are concerned about gun issues. And afterward, you saw Shannon Watts and other members of the organization come out and say, no, Michael Bloomberg did not start our organization. We coordinated with him after we had developed our grassroots organization. This is an issue for him because you are offending people again by taking credit for things simply because you were the person who was able to infuse resources, monetary resources, into it.
I fact-checked a couple of things, and Bloomberg did, Warren criticized him for this, Imani, donated, it looks like $250,000 to a PAC for Senator Graham, and this was in 2014. Also gave $11.7 million to Pennsylvania Republican Pat Toomey's reelection campaign, and did not support the Democrat Katie McGinty, who did lose by less than 100,000 votes, but seems like he's got some explaining to do.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, I think it's you know, no secret that Bloomberg is relatively conservative for the current Democratic Party. I also think, you know, there's anytime someone runs for president, there's a great deal of ego, and there's also hopefully a belief in public service. And I think what happens in once one sort of looks at how he is navigating and throwing a lot of money around, the question, of course, emerges, well, with that amount of money, could you actually be responsible for flipping the Senate? Or could you actually intervene in areas of deep suffering in this country in a way that, if you are deeply committed to service, that might be a priority? And then there is also the issue, of course, of there's a lot of misrepresentation. I mean, particularly when he was talking about New York schools, for example, and you know, improving them when during his tenure, they had the lowest rate of African-American graduation in the country.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
So, you know, there's a lot of fact checking to do. Mm-hmm.
Let me read some comments. I'll toss this to you, Michael. Kent says, for what it's worth, I think it's very difficult undertaking to try and predict how people will vote in the general election. The traditional party seems to be certain that Sanders can't win. Polls say otherwise, but let's all remember Donald Trump is the president, and no one saw that coming until it was a reality. Are we in that sort of 2016 mode of just everything is in flux, do you think?
I think electability is hard to predict, and we're having the conversation about which of these candidates is more electable. And at this point in time, I don't know that we actually know.
Right.
And so, as people have pointed out, one of the tests of electability is winning, and winning makes you more electable. So as we move,
so there you go, right?
As we move forward in these primaries, eventually the field will become clearer as some candidates actually begin winning and or continue winning these primaries, and that will clarify things. So no, I don't think we actually know about what will happen in the general election.
Do you think, Kelly, that means that whoever the winner is, who they choose as a vice president, will be even more important this year? Again, this is all speculation.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is another question that, you know, political science, especially historically terrible at knowing, predicting. I think with the vice presidential pick, there is a concern about sort of overall representation. If the Democratic Party is staking its claims on being the most representative and inclusive party, we've already seen the criticism of that in this presidential race, where the candidates of color have been edged out due to a number of reasons, including financial reasons. Might see that with the women candidates. And so I do think the vice presidential space might be an area where you demonstrate that type of inclusivity, but it's not enough. And so the danger that a candidate gets into, if it's a white male candidate, is saying, like, don't worry, I've got it covered because I chose, you know, a black woman or I chose a Latino man. That is not enough to convince communities of voters that you're going to speak to their issues and their concerns.
Here's a question from Ricky Mani, who says, I found it odd that there were Bloomberg commercials during the break, debate breaks. Why would the network allow this? And I also was kind of shocked.
Yeah.
And a very anti-Bernie ad as well, coming from a group I did not recognize.
Yes, it was. I found that troubling. I mean, I think, you know, we've been talking about this for decades, but the the dangers of so much money being in politics. And I think Bloomberg now, this cycle, stands as a representative of this idea that, you know, that who spends the most money historically, I mean, the last election this wasn't the case, but who spends the most money wins, right? And so,
yeah. Let me play another clip. And this is Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and he's claiming that Bernie Sanders' agenda would hurt down ballot races, including the race for the House of Representatives for Democrats across the country.
It adds up to four more years of Donald Trump, Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House, and the inability to get the Senate into Democratic hands. The time has come for us to stop acting like the presidency is the only office that matters. Not only is this a way to get Donald Trump reelected, we got a House to worry about. We got a Senate to worry about. And this is really important. Look,
hello.
If you want to keep the House in Democratic hands, you might want to check with the people who actually turned the House blue. 40 Democrats who are not running on your platform. They are running away from your platform as fast as they possibly can. I want to send those Democrats back to the United States House. Let's listen to them.
Michael, does he have a point, do you think? Again, speculation.
Yes. There's certainly a lot of worry on the part of the Democratic establishment, however you want to define them, that, yes, if Bernie Sanders becomes the candidate, that it will mean trouble down ballot. And you hear this not just among other elected officials, but you also hear it on the pages of op-ed pages and radio shows. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of concern. How real that is hard to predict. So when things come to the point where people are actually casting their ballots, will that mean that this will be an issue? You know, certainly the kinds of things that that candidates point to with Sanders' platform, Medicaid for all, some of the positions we were talking about earlier in foreign policy, there are concerns
Pre-college.
There. And these came up during this debate. Mm-hmm. But none of those really gained a lot of traction in a debate that was organized differently, where people had to go had a chance to go more fully in depth on these kinds of questions. That would get more play. And maybe going forward, that will get more play.
What do you think, Kelly and Inamani?
Just one quick thing on Sanders, too. I think there's another concern beyond general concerns about socialism and the term democratic socialist. Will it scare voters? I also think he has struggled with uniting the party, if you will, right? So
this will
a
be
lot
Sanders.
Of the. Yeah, Sanders, and particularly his supporters, right? So the negativity that we've seen online, the negativity we've seen on air from some of his surrogates and his supporters, I do think that also is a challenge then for this conversation that Buttigieg is having down ballot. If you don't have a candidate at the top of the ticket, or if you do have a candidate who seems to marginalize people who don't agree with him, which gets back to this concern about flexibility, I think there is the potential that he doesn't energize the rest of the electorate that is needed to win the White House.
Do you think the Democratic Party, Mani, though, needs either Republicans or people that voted for Trump? I mean, is that part of the job, is to figure out how to create
right.
this big tent?
I do think the big tent is important. I think there's a number of different ways to get there, right? You can include, you know, so you can bring in people who don't traditionally vote. You can bring in independents. You can bring in moderate Republicans. And that all depends upon, you know, what the platform is, but also what the strategy is. And also the people who are just generally politically disengaged, right? So there is a big tent that is that's necessary. I guess I also, and this goes to Kelly's point, one of the challenges that I think Sanders poses is that it's not a big tent model that actually thinks about different sort of group interests in a variety of ways. So it's like, well, these things should matter to everybody, which is different from a kind of politics of coalition that I think is ultimately a more successful sort of way to think about how you bring people in, even, but you know, you can do that even while sustaining your particular politics, right? So
yeah, I mean, so it's a tricky dance in a lot of ways. To you, Michael, I was reading about the Latinx vote described, and you can, you know, you may not like this, as a sleeping giant, but as for Latinx voters less likely to vote in this country, at least in elections past.
Right.
Do you think that's changing?
So the sleeping giant metaphor has been used now for many election cycles.
Do you hate it?
I do quite hate
okay.
it.
Just checking.
Yes. This is the supposedly the first election, presidential election cycle where the Latinx vote is going to be the largest non-white electoral vote election. Popular vote.
Yep.
And so will they awaken? And there's signs that again, there are generational differences where younger Latino voters are particularly engaged in this election and have. On the whole, been supportive of Bernie Sanders. I think one of the challenges for any candidate that succeeds going forward will be bringing the various wings of the party together. And if it's not Bernie Sanders, if it's someone who's in the moderate wing, you have to ask the question to them, like how will they bring the wings of the party together, the more progressive wings, this younger cohort of young voters, many of whom are multiracial and are bringing in a different kind of energy into the conversation in the Democratic Party.
Well, let me play another clip, and this is Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was staking out that middle along with Pete Buttigieg, criticizing the Democratic candidates for fracturing the party. Let's give it a listen.
If we spend the next 4 months tearing our party apart, we're going to watch Donald Trump spend the next 4 years tearing our country apart.
Look. I mean, Imani, we didn't hear a lot of Donald Trump talk last night, and we haven't heard that in previous debates either.
Right.
This is number 10,
yeah,
I should say.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that the problem with that formulation, I mean, I do think there is always the consideration, right, the potential that they damage all of each other so badly that once you get the nominee, that person is really wounded. But the problem with that kind of formulation is that the critique of fracturing the party tends to be we have to maintain the status quo. And the status quo is not working, was not working, you know, even in the last administration for a large portion of the Democratic electorate. And so, yes, maybe, you know, the mode of engagement could be better, but, you know, there are some serious differences. There is a civil war inside the Democratic Party.
No question. Let me just do one more clip just to give everyone equal time from last night. And this is Tom Steyer pointing to Bernie Sanders' self-identified democratic socialism and Michael Bloomberg's history of being a Republican as a problem for traditional Democrats.
This conversation shows a huge risk for the Democratic Party. We are looking at a party that has decided that we're either going to support someone who's a democratic socialist or somebody who has a long history of being a Republican.
Is the party, Kelly, having an identity crisis or a nervous breakdown?
Yeah, I mean,
what?
And I think Imani said civil war. I mean, I think there really is that. Also, Steyer actually, he has a point here in two ways. One is that neither of those men, Bernie or Bloomberg, have always been Democrats. So we're talking about nominating somebody for a party for whom these folks have not been members and supporters. And so I think that's really something for us to consider in thinking about who we want to choose to represent the party. Also, Steyer raises a question about electability around ideological differences and distance in a way that I think is also important. As somebody who does a lot on gender and politics, I've taken a lot of calls and spoken a lot on the electability of women. But I haven't seen a lot of articles about the electability of a democratic socialist or the electability of a billionaire who was formerly a Republican. So I think if we're going to be critical about whether or not somebody can win because of their identity, then we should be looking at all of these identities and how they resonate with voters.
Final thought, Michael, because we're almost out of time here.
So I think civil war is too strong. And I think there's a real conversation taking place among Democrats about what the party is going to look like in the post-Obama years.
Mm-hmm.
And Democrats haven't decided yet what that is going to look like. And there are conversations, many of which we've touched on here, about what's the role of money going to be?
Right.
How is that going to play out? The Democratic Party has been uncomfortable with the role of money, but it is a reality. And so how to grapple with that? What role do we want it to play? the fact that the Democratic Party as an institution is weaker than it has been, just as the Republican Party has been weaker. So how is that going to play out? And then the role of new actors, new younger voters, and how they're going to be incorporated into the vision of the Democratic Party.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Michael Jones Correa, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Kelly Dittmar, thank you for coming in as well. And Imani, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Imani Perry. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow, and thanks so much for joining us.